From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we explore the many ways in which journeys, both physical and mental, can shape us.
First, how an introvert came to enjoy the interactions he had with people over the course of a cross-country bike trip.
I still believe there is something to be said for the open landscape and how that must change one's mindset.
Later, a Milwaukee man publishes the remarkable travel journal that his father kept on the trip of a lifetime, 2 months in Europe in 1936.
Over time, it was edited and re-edited and revised, and upon its completion, it occurred to me that this is something that covers so many topics of interest, particularly during this time in which we live, that it might be worth actually turning it into book form.
And we learn about a cross-country trek by two Wisconsin veterans and how it helped them deal with the aftermath of combat.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. People have been riding some form of bicycle for nearly 200 years. Whether you ride a road bike, a mountain bike, a tandem, or even a fat tire in the wintertime, they each serve many recreational and practical purposes.
However, it takes a special relationship with biking and yourself to embark on a solo bike tour from Seattle, Washington, all the way to Milwaukee. But that's exactly what Milwaukee native David Howell did, and his journaling during his experience spawned a book, The Descent into Happiness, a bicycling journey over the Cascades and Rockies and across the Great Plains.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski sat down with Howell earlier this year to discuss his experience, and he starts by explaining the concept of his controlled risk.
The best thing I could do in preparation was just be prepared for the unexpected and know that I didn't exactly know what I was getting into, which I find really kind of exciting. I like the adventure part of that. And it kind of gets back to that idea of controlled risk, where it's not foolishness. I think a lot of people I talk to about this experience think it's kind of redonk to go ride your bike for 30 days in a row and try to travel a lot of the country. A lot of people, I think, assume that it's very dangerous to be out there, maybe because they've never ridden their bikes outside of their neighborhoods. But I wanted to have that experience. I had read enough stories written by other people who had the experience that I knew. You know, there was an element of safety to it if you planned and you prepared. Of course, you know, there are people who experience tragedy out there. There are people who, riding their bikes, get hit by cars and whatnot. And you have to account for those variables as well. And I did that as best as I possibly could, while knowing that there is an element to risk, just like there's an element to risk in riding my bike to work every day.
Well, and you didn't exactly go into this not knowing what direction you were going. You did have some resources and a general idea of places you could stay. So when you're just biking around as much as you can in town, did you do any other physical preparations, like any strength training? Because your bike has an additional 50 pounds of gear that you're lugging around. Just kind of go into any of the other physical aspects that you either needed to do, or did you just accept that this is whole new territory, and once I'm on my bike, that I got to adjust and deal with what's happening?
Well, I've done a lot of reading on training for different kinds of endurance events. And one thing that I've learned is that the more years you do this kind of activity, the more likely you can continue to do it. So yeah, I did 6 Ironman triathlons over the span of 6 years and decided to transition into bike touring because, you know, it takes a lot of time to train for Ironman. But I think that that really does something to one's body in terms of muscle memory, but also just in terms of enabling yourself to know how long you can spend working out in a given day, if that makes sense. So that's why I think when I had this experience of the long bike ride, it wasn't that much of a learning curve in terms of physical fitness because my body knew the stress I was going to put it under. Certainly in the first few days, it was difficult. I think on the second day, I had a huge bonk because I was so overwhelmed with what I was doing that I wasn't drinking enough water, I wasn't eating enough food, and I just had to stop on the side of the road for about an hour and eat a jar of peanut butter and drink 16 ounces of water and try to get to the point where I could keep moving forward. So, yeah, you know, it's a learning experience. You make mistakes. Hopefully you get back in the bike and keep going.
How did you adjust to that? In keeping a healthy mind and body, that's one of the main goals, of course, that you had. So when you had that first rock in the road and needed to really be aware of, okay, I need to be fueling my body a lot more, keeping on going. So as you went further and into more days of riding, different landscapes, how did you adjust your mind and body to keep that healthy?
Well, I learned a lot from other cyclists because, you know, once you go out there, you meet other people who are doing the same thing. I was lucky in that on the third day, I met three guys who just graduated from college on the East Coast, and they were, I think, 45 days into their bike ride across the country. So I was 3 days in, they had 3 days left. So, I just sat them down and offered to make them dinner and drilled them with questions to find out all of the things that they had done and learned along the way. So when I told them that the previous day I, you know, completely depleted myself, they kind of laughed because they made the same mistake going out. So that gave me a degree of comfort. I wasn't the first person to make that mistake. But then they told me that your body just acclimates, your mind acclimates. They were glad that they were doing it among the three of them. They were very, very good friends. But I think they were each interested in having the experience of a solo ride, maybe at a later date. Every day I met more cyclists. 2 days later, when I was crossing into Montana, I met a couple from Iowa who started in Maine, who had retired from their farm. I think they were in their 70s. And they were traveling all the way back on their bikes, kind of hotel camping, credit card camping. But it just gave me hope for the future that I, you know, this is something I can do for the rest of my life, for the next 40 years. I met other cyclists who had just done the Rocky Mountains, a lot of off-road stuff, which made what I was doing look easy in comparison. And they're just very normal people having an amazing experience, but no one necessarily defined it as amazing. It was just that heightened state of normal.
Do you find, as a self-proclaimed introvert, that this was the perfect balance of interacting with people when you wanted to, and if you needed to, you could just continue riding on the road by yourself?
Yeah, when I planned out the trip, I didn't think about how I would be around people more on the first third of it because I was in the mountains. And, you know, a lot of people will do a ride that starts in Seattle and ends at Glacier National Park. Then they'll just hop on the Amtrak and train their way back to Seattle. Or they'll throw their bikes into the back of a U-Haul and maybe go down to Yosemite because the prospect of biking across the Great Plains is arduous in the minds of many. So, you know, fortunately, I had ignorance on my side. I didn't know what I was getting into. And I just started riding across those big, beautiful Great Plains where there's hardly anyone. But I think, once again, the quality of the human interaction was enhanced because it was less frequent. I was looking forward to the next time I would see somebody. And the acts of generosity that people were exercising grew exponentially. It was not uncommon for someone to stop and offer me a bottle of water or to stop and let me know that they were going to be camping down the road and I was more than welcome to join them for dinner. This happened on a daily basis, and it really gave me an appreciation for the human spirit and for the people who live out there in the middle of nowhere.
In this whole journey, you have three things that stand out in particular that you learned. Number one, solitude feeds the marriage, and marriage feeds the solitude. Number two, the Northern Tier diet working. And number three, I need to exercise my humanity more consistently. So let's go down into this. And obviously, you were touring alone and learned a lot about yourself, but a lot of these other things, these three lessons, interconnect with other people. So to start, solitude feeding the marriage and the marriage feeding the solitude, because I imagine a lot of people would look upon you with skepticism when you say, oh, yeah, my wife's all good with this. Like, I'm going to be going away for this amount of time. You know, it was, over a month? But you still kept in contact with your wife daily. So that, to me, that was curious on how your marriage was fed through this solo journey.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, my wife is my best friend. We spend a lot of time together by choice. But we're both introverted, so we have to enable ourselves to spend time on our own as well. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, this was the great problem that I had to solve because my whole life with her, really my whole adult life, has involved this conflict. And early in our relationship, it was difficult because I would go and I would travel, you know, backpacking through Europe for 5 months while we were dating, maybe another trip through Southeast Asia for a few months. And when I would come back from those experiences, I just didn't know how to reengage in the relationship. That was why it was a bit of an outlier on this trip. You know, how could I go back into our marriage again after I had been away from it for 30 days? But I think that was the realization. And it didn't really hit me all at once. It was more over the span of a couple of days. And that's where I think the writing really helped as well, because it is such a wonderfully reflective activity that I kept writing down everything I was learning while I was riding my bike. And you're correct, a lot of these things tended to overlap. So when I realized that this time alone gave me ample opportunity to appreciate our relationship, I knew that it was helping the marriage, even though it wasn't directly helping our relationship. So I had that idea. Well, you know, maybe time alone means I'll be better prepared to be with her. And when I'm with her, and if I really make the most of my time with her, then maybe that's going to prepare me for those opportunities in my day-to-day life to be alone. So instead of letting those two things be at odds, I just had to make a mental shift in order to let them complement each other. And it's really working.
Secondly, the Northern Tier diet, you mentioned you had difficulties gaining back the weight after you trained for an Ironman event or something, that you didn't keep consistency between the events. So how did it follow through after the end of this trip?
Yeah, well, you know, Milwaukee is a beer city,
yes.
And I love beer. So one thing that surprised me was I was dropping about a pound a day. I think I lost 25 pounds over the 32 days of the trip. So at the end of the ride, I thought, well, okay, it feels good to be lighter. I wonder if I can maintain this in my life back in Milwaukee. So I went to a nutritionist, and she told me everything that I would need to do. Probably, you know, less beer, maybe less bourbon, stay away from rices and grains. And I failed miserably at all of that because I love to have a beer at the end of the day and eat good food. So my plan is to just have another big bike ride and drop weight again and see if I can not make the same mistake. But it's something that kind of surprised me. I didn't really plan on losing a lot of weight. It just kind of happened. Had I been more intentional about shifting my lifestyle in that direction, I think it probably would have stuck better. But there was another problem I was trying to resolve. So I was okay with it when I did get back to Milwaukee, and I just went right back to my original weight.
Well, and I'd say you deserve a drink after all that biking.
Well, and it's not hard to find people who like enjoying beer out there on the open road. That was another fun part of it.
And lastly, exercising your humanity more consistently. On the road, you encountered people being very generous without any prompting. So how did you take this back with you and apply this here in Milwaukee?
You know, I have to admit, before this trip, I wasn't a real big fan of our species. One of the reasons why I think I enjoy being alone so much is, I wouldn't say an aversion to human contact, but I don't like being disappointed by people. So when you're out there and you are consistently running into people who are willing to invite you into their home or share a meal, or just have a conversation with you and to listen to you tell their story. When that happens 32 days in a row, it's got to leave a mark. And if you ignore that information, I think it's to your detriment. So it made me believe in humanity once again. And that's something that I have been able to hold on to, fortunately. But it's also something that I think I need to maintain. So that's why I need to go back on another long bike ride, is to once again meet great people out there on the open road. And probably look for more people in my community here in Milwaukee who share those same qualities. But I still believe there is something to be said for the open landscape and how that must change one's mindset. I mean, if you live in a small town like Gackle, Montana, where there's only 57 people, there's probably other people who spend a lot of time alone doing their work or whatever it is that they do. That has to have an effect as compared to living in a dense urban population.
Well, this book was certainly enlightening, and I look forward to hearing about your next grand adventure this summer.
Yeah.
And Dave, thanks so much for coming in to talk about it.
Well, thank you for hosting me.
David Howell is a Milwaukee native, a professor in the Humanities Department at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, and the author of The Descent into Happiness. You can find a link to both parts of his discussion with Audrey Nowakowski at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break now, and when we return, we'll hear about a travel journal from 1936 and what makes it worth reading today. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
But I'm not the type to care, 'cause I've got a pocket full of dreams.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Check your Facebook or your Instagram right now, and the chances are good you might know someone who is, at this very moment, traveling through Europe. Not that it is an inexpensive trip, but we're a mobile enough society that hearing about a trip to Europe these days hardly raises an eyebrow.
Americans traveled to Europe in the 1930s as well, but for many who did in those days, it qualified as the trip of a lifetime. That was certainly the case for Frank J. Daly, a 30-year-old schoolteacher from Chicago. Daly spent 2 months in Europe in 1936, a time when the specter of war was beginning to loom.
Daly passed away some time ago, and his trip would have been long forgotten, except that a two-volume journal of his journey survived and was discovered by his son, Milwaukee attorney Frank Daly. And the writing was vivid enough that the younger Daly thought others might want to read it. And so, with the assistance of journalist and editor Kurt Chandler, the book, My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936, was born. Daly and Chandler joined us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly, when did you first read your father's travel journal?
Shortly after the time that I discovered it among his belongings after his death in 1997, when we were cleaning out his belongings back in Chicago, and it was contained in these journals which we found, which were sort of at the bottom of a box that had many other mementos in it and some of his writings and other things that we were going through trying to determine what to keep and what not to. And I read hurriedly through it. Oh, I was astounded because I did not know they existed. Nice thing, it seems to be jiving with what I'd been told as a boy, and then being the extraordinarily efficient and capable a state administrator, I thought, well, we probably don't need these. Where am I going to put these? So I was thinking about discarding them, and my wife, Julie Ebert, another lawyer from Quarles-Aubrey, said, "No, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that you might regret that if you do that. And even though it might be in our basement, that's okay, because it's the kind of thing that creates a number of memories, and it might be a very valuable memoir someday." And she was absolutely right. So I'm grateful for her insight. And then later had occasion to read a little bit more. And then after my retirement from the active practice of law, I set about the task of trying to dictate these, because I was fairly able to read my father's penmanship, which is sort of elegant but not always legible. And the books were not in the best of condition. Some of the pages had been water stained and were sort of loose and falling, but they were all there. And so after a lot of arduous attempts, I was able to get a working draft of
typewritten version of these so that it would be easier to work with. And then over time, it was edited and re-edited and revised. And upon its completion, it occurred to me that this is something that covers so many topics of interest, particularly during this time in which we live, that it might be worth actually turning it into book form. And that's when I talked to Kurt to get his good assistance and advice on that.
Well, and you said you did not know that these journals existed, but at the same time, it sounds like you were very much aware of this trip. This was something that he talked about.
That's correct. He termed it always as the trip of a lifetime, and had planned that trip, astonishingly to me, from the time he was about a 10-year-old boy till he took the trip when he was age 30. And his feeling of joy and his feeling of fulfillment is just reflected all through the pages of the things that he had so long to see, and obviously had done a great deal of research, which astonishes me. I mean, he was a school teacher, but came from a family where he was the only child of nine who actually proceeded to school past the age of 16. It was an Irish working family, and people were supposed to go out and start contributing. His father was not happy with his decision to pursue his education. But his education was not just in the classroom or in the work that he did, but rather on his own. And he had read extensively about places in Europe and had a remarkable conception of what they would be like. And then to see that anticipation unfold with his own experiences and his expression of that was a remarkable feeling.
Kurt, so Frank Daly brings you this manuscript. You know, not everybody's journal is really, and you know, it's a journal, so it's not necessarily meant for on the record, you know, public reading. What struck you immediately about it that made it worth, you know, made it compelling and worth your time?
Well, I guess initially it was his keen eye for detail. This was a daily journal. So he kept
notes. No pun intended, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, a daily journal by a daily named Frank. But he really had an eye for even the smallest things. His observations were really spot on, I thought. And they were spot on in the year 1936. So in reading this, you know, 80 years later, I got a real strong sense of history based on his chronicles, his very descriptive chronicles, and that's what pulled me into these journals, to this journal. At first, I thought, okay, well, it's somebody's travelogue, but it was far more than that, you know, after I started reading it, and that's what intrigued me.
Well, and I think about, you know, early travel logs, you know, you think of Mark Twain and you think of, you know, you think of some of the classic, you know, Hemingway-esque writers out there. And one of the things that strikes me about this is, you know, this is a travel log written by an ordinary guy, which, you know, there aren't a lot of those out there. How was he even able to make this trip happen? It must have cost a fortune in those days.
It must have, and that's one of the mysteries that I have never quite solved, except that there's mention in the book frequently of a man named William Beale, who was a travel agent, and apparently a friend of my father. I'm not sure how he was a friend all through the time I was a young boy, as a matter of fact. But he somehow must have gotten other kinds of concessions, and which enabled my father to be able to go. It's also clear that my father had been saving for this trip since it was a trip virtually since the time of being a teenager and when he was earning some money. It was a combination of those. But I agree. I was amazed at the what this must have cost. I can't imagine what it would cost today. It'd be just staggering. The other thing that occurred to me when I was coming back from New York recently in O'Hare Field and watching people pick up their luggage at the baggage claim areas was, how in the world did he pack for 2 months? And when there were suitcases didn't have wheels, they were not lightweight, there were no backpacks, and yet he had a pack extensively because he had all different environments he was going to be in, including formal attire for being on shipboard for parties and dances and plays and whatnot. Obviously, was something that was planned, and I think that this William Beale was no doubt an important influence, both in terms of his anticipation of it, but also in terms of his ability to know what to pack and how to pack and to how to travel within Europe.
One thing that he does not seem to have had is a camera. In some ways, this journal really seems like it substitutes for having a camera.
Mitch, that's precisely what I felt as I read it. It was like being in the moment with him. It was being and having gone then and using his book as a guide. Something, what he described was a perfect picture of what I was actually looking at, the Colosseum in Rome, all of the places in Paris, the Eiffel Tower, the Sorbonne, the Louvre, Notre Dame, the walk along the Seine with the artists and booksellers, all there when I went there, and just the descriptive talent he had was amazing. His descriptions of the Palace of Versailles, for example, are quite detailed. And when I was there, look, I was just astonished by the minute observations that he would make of the gold in the rooms and of the design of the couches and things like that. So that his book actually painted a picture for the mind when you're reading it.
I think his insatiable curiosity is what drove him here and really compelled him to jot things down in this journal every day. He was very disciplined. And he also had, I think, an incredible insight. I mean, he was sort of charmed by European life. I mean, he had never been abroad, and so the customs and the styles and the way people spoke and dressed were all a fascination to him. And so he was able to just pick little things from his observation, like, for example, he said Italians are much better dancers than Hollanders or Germans.
So I know some people in Milwaukee who would dissent strongly to that.
So he was very astute about what was going on around him. He was very present.
You know, and there's so many stops along the way, and obviously we can't talk about all of them,
sure.
But I appreciate that you've been bringing some up. In some ways, it almost feels like a Forrest Gump-like trip through Europe. I mean, he had an audience with the Pope.
Right. Yeah, I'm standing right next to him. Unimaginable, and especially in today's times.
Well, and apparently he knew just how to get that.
Well, again, through the travel arrangements that Mr. Beale made and introducing him to a priest who was on board the ship who then had the connections with people in the Vatican. And being from Chicago, my father knew how to use political connections.
He is not from that Daly family,
He's
though.
Not, and it's just regrettable. I might have been a mayor if I'd said.
And a fine mayor.
But I think part of it, Mitch, too, is that I think he must have done a lot of preparing for this. I mean, he sort of knew in advance what he wanted to see, sort of what it looked like. And I thought when each time I read it, I thought it reflected the feeling that anybody who I think travels to Europe or some other foreign for the first time.
And at the same time, he's seeing these things and he's also experiencing what life is becoming as the Nazis have risen
right.
to power in Germany, as the fascists are in power in Italy, and he's able to reflect on what that looks and feels like.
Yes, I thought his comments were very astute, and in particular, there's a few things in there that addresses those questions. And one of them was when he was first docked, the ship was docked off the coast of France while some of its passengers were disembarking. He was standing by the railing observing all this. And he said, you know, there was a gentle wind blowing toward me, which seemed to carry with it the odor of the farms of France. And that also brought me back many years to my pleasant farm vacations in Illinois. A faint suggestion of red in the far western sky caused me to think of the Great War being World War I and the fact that the wind I so enjoyed had blown over the graves of millions of dead men buried in Europe. That, to me, was an extraordinary. But then the kicker to that is a prescient comment that says it also suggested the imminence of another great Holocaust brought senselessly because of the selfishness of men and the unwarranted greed for power, which has a real current ring to it, in my view.
Well, another thing that kind of tickles me throughout is his kind of reviews of the service he gets, the people he meets. You know, Italians dancing, but the kind of service he gets at hotels, even reviewing how different people in different countries worship.
Right. Yes. And I think all of that becomes more amazing when you consider the humbleness of his background. I mean, working from working class Irish in the south side of Chicago. Now, he had not been somebody that was able to enjoy lavish dinners or great service. He'd obviously read about those things. And so when it occurred, it impressed him perhaps even more, and especially more than if he had had some of that experience. But throughout, too, he also had views that I thought reflected well on his consideration of things, where he said that so much of life has to do with status and so much of status has to do with birth, and we're all born equal, but the equality ends shortly thereafter.
If I understand correctly, despite the trip of a lifetime and the incredible things that he saw and wrote about, aside from one trip to Ireland, he never returned to Europe.
That's correct. I mean, part of it may be because of the burden of having a son who had to be educated, and the salary of a public school teacher in Chicago was not of great stature. But I think so much of what he absorbed in Europe was something that he carried with him then the rest of his life. And he thought about it often. He would see examples of it in architecture in Chicago or elsewhere. And it was indeed the trip of a lifetime, and turned out to be something that sustained him intellectually as well as emotionally for the rest of his life.
You, looking back at it, I mean, you said you'd always heard about this trip.
Mm-hmm.
Having read these journals now, do you think you know or understand anything differently about your father for having spent so much time reading these words?
I think I know him a little bit better. I mean, he was, for example, he shows a side of social skills that I think have certainly exceeded my anticipation. He was a fairly strict disciplinarian. So to see him cavorting about the dance floor with Italian women who he said whose dancing was more biological than physical, this is something that I could not imagine my father actually doing or saying. And coming in and out of these despicable places in Paris with naked women and the like, and simply pointing out what they were like, and otherwise enjoying a beer at the end of a day and watching the Glockenspiel in Munich from a beer garden, and sipping wine and enjoying all of these kind of continental pleasures were all things that I would not have imagined for my father. And it makes me feel much better about him.
We should note, though, at one point he does write, at a certain point, one becomes satiated and ceases to record impressions. A traveler needs lots of rest because rapidity and number of impressions is a tax on the nervous system.
Indeed it is. And having my travel myself, when I read that, I was relieved because I thought it might be just me in terms of endurance. But and one of those times was when he was in Berlin and he was absolutely overwhelmed by everything is sheer volume of all the things going on. You know, you have the Reichstag and you've got this, and the Olympics are coming there. So he's at the Olympic Stadium, and they're having rehearsals and doing, and the Nazis soldiers marched in uniform, and he would not stand up, and they came over to him and told him, "You must stand up and say Heil Hitler." And he refused to do that and said, "I will only stand up and salute the flag of America." That's a story he told many times that has always resonated with me. And I always thought if he'd done that 3 years later, I would never be here because he would have been immediately executed, I think. But that thing, the thing in Berlin with all of this going on and the overwhelming presence of the Nazis and the swastikas and the parades and the fireworks and all of it was so emotionally and physically taxing that he didn't record those regularly in his diary.
Well, Frank Daly and Kurt Chandler, we are very grateful that you've shared it with us. Thank you both so much.
Mitch, our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly's late father, Frank J. Daly, was the author, and Kurt Chandler, the modern-day editor of My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936. You can see photographs of Daly's 1936 travel journal at WUWM.com.
And coming up next, we'll learn how a cross-country trek helped two Wisconsin veterans' ability to heal after tours of duty in Iraq. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier in the show, we spoke with David Howell, who traveled across most of the country by bike. One of his goals of the journey was to connect with the different people, landscapes, and his own thought process. Well, two veterans set out on a journey with a similar mission in mind, except they traveled by foot.
The documentary Almost Sunrise chronicles that journey. Anthony Anderson and Tom Voss grew up in southeast Wisconsin. They both served in Iraq and undertook the trek from Milwaukee to the California coast to come to terms with the impacts of combat.
In 2004 and 2005, Tom Voss was stationed in northern Iraq. He was 21 at the time, and during his time there, he saw his platoon sergeant and other squad leaders killed in action and was himself injured by shrapnel.
As they sat down to talk about the cross-country journey, Voss tells Lake Effect Susan Benz he was raised with a deep sense of service.
My grandfather was a World War II veteran, a Marine, and he fought on Iwo Jima, was awarded the Purple Heart, Navy Cross, and then he went on to serve as a judge in Waukesha County. So, you know, from a very young age, you know, it was kind of instilled in me that, you know, you serve. That's kind of the driving force behind me wanting to be in the military was really my grandfather. So when I joined, it wasn't really a question of am I doing the right thing or is this going to be dangerous? And I specifically joined the infantry for that reason, is because that's what I imagined. If you're going to be in the military, that's what you do. You're on the front lines and you're the one doing the work, not the support aspect of it.
So when your service was over, between that time and the big trek, think back how you were getting along.
Not very well. I mean, I got out of the military in 2006. And then I immediately enrolled in school full-time. I got a full-time job working security at hotels, working second and third shifts, going to school full-time, and then got my own place and just really just trying to catch up with my peers because a lot of them were graduating college at the time. So I felt I needed to fit in, and that ended up, you know, I ended up crashing and burning essentially because I didn't address any of the things that happened to me in my deployment. So from about 2006 to really 2013, I was struggling pretty hard, and I was using alcohol to self-medicate, dropping out of school, you know, on a bunch of prescription medications from the VA hospital. So it was all kind of a rough period of time for me.
Absolutely. So what got into your head when you decided, okay, I'm taking off, I'm hiking across the country?
Well, it was either that or I was probably going to kill myself. So that, you know, seemed like the choice that needed to be made at that time, because, you know, I was at the edge, and I really didn't really see a way out, and that was the only thing that I could see that could help me, or at least give me some time to kind of catch my breath and really assess what is going on. And it was really out of necessity, I think.
I've had the chance to speak with Anthony Anderson. So how did the two of you team up?
Well, I actually called Anthony and asked him if he had a rucksack that I could borrow, because I didn't really have one at the time. And I knew that he had a bunch of gear from his time in. I called him and asked him, and he wanted to know, you know, what I needed one for. And I told him that when I'm walking out to California to see a couple of buddies that I served with. And he, you know, kind of said that he needed to take that time as well, because he was kind of in the same boat. So he asked if he could come along. I said, no, not a problem at all. And from there, it kind of turned into Veterans Trek, where we wanted to do a awareness campaign, a fundraiser, and work on, you know, our issues moving forward.
How did it go from the two of us are going to go, we need this desperately, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life or if my life can go on, moving from that to sort of a big movement that was followed by a number of people, et cetera, et cetera, that was a big step to take. And I'm wondering how that happened.
It was really kind of second nature for us, because, I mean, we're both infantry, we're both military, and when we have a mission, you just kind of snap into that mode. So once we agreed to do it, you know, we were both committed 100% to it. We just kind of dove right into it, like, okay, you know, this is going to happen, and how are we going to move forward with it? So
part of your nature, really.
Part of the
core of who you are.
So, right.
So 5 months later, is that what it was? 5 months of trekking?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the early days were slow going, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty difficult. Wisconsin was probably one of the hardest states for us. That was only because we really knew all the landmarks and distances and everything like that. So if you're walking from Waukesha and you see a sign from Madison that says 91 miles, and you're like, oh, you know exactly, because you've driven it so much that you know exactly where it is. So it was a mental and physical challenge for us to begin in the beginning.
What were some of the things going on in your head and that you experienced over those 5 months? Is that possible to put into words?
Yeah, I think that my whole thing was really coming to terms with the death of my friends. So that's one of the major things that I hadn't really looked at or addressed that I really started to do on the walk. I mean, there's so much other stuff on top of that that, you know, was affecting me, but those were the two main things that I was kind of analyzing, I guess you could say, is how, before I went on the trek, my thought pattern was, how could I have done something differently to affect the outcome of the death of my friends? Or why did I not die instead of them? And there was just survivor guilt. There was all this shame and sorrow and all that kind of stuff associated with it. So it's really kind of wading through all that and, you know, coming to the realization that, you know, there's nothing I can do about it and that there's nothing that I can do to change that. So, and it sounds like, oh, yeah, that's easy, you know, it's a realization, duh, you can't change it. But, like, to really believe that when you've been in that situation is so difficult because it's such a traumatic experience that is ingrained in you.
Watching the film, I felt it did a good job of conveying how wrenching and difficult it was to continue on and to sort through it for yourself. It just, it was really profoundly moving.
Thank you.
I think I'll jump to the documentary itself. So how was it that mm-hmm. this piece came out of your peacemaking?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I think that the director, Michael Collins, worked with Anthony a few months earlier doing a study at the University of Wisconsin, and that's how they met. So Michael was online, I guess he was searching for projects, and he was really interested in veterans projects because he was really, kind of moved by his experience, I guess, interviewing these veterans. So he came across our Kickstarter. He was just immediately like, oh, I know that guy, that's Anthony, and ended up calling him. And this was the Kickstarter that we were doing to kind of fundraise for our trek, essentially. That's how that connection was made. And then Michael reached out, you know, asked if he could come and talk to us and film us a little bit to see if he could get enough access to make a film out of it. So he interviewed our families and us, decided that he could and that he was going to commit to following us.
You and Anthony co-founded Veterans Trek, so that was the name you gave as you traveled in 2013. It's living on. Your vision is to work with or encourage other veterans to not necessarily walk the country, but to use nature as a part of healing. Do I have that straight?
That's correct. Yeah, really just being out in nature and taking the time and utilizing peer support. I think the idea behind it is to start the process, and that's a good way to do it, is, you know, physical activity, relying on your peers, and being in nature.
So how is the U.S. Forest Service involved in this?
Yeah, a few years ago, we started talking with the Forest Service about, you know, how we can work together, because there's a lot of, veterans typically really enjoy being in nature. I mean, we train in it, we're in it a lot, and we just felt like it was kind of a natural fit. So I ended up approaching the U.S. Forest Service, which I believe it's Region 7 or 9, or I'm not really sure off the top of my head. They're located in Milwaukee. So their headquarters are there. So I set up a meeting and kind of just asked them, you know, what can we do? How can we work together? This is what we're thinking of, and ended up taking maybe a year or so, but we ended up working out a deal where the U.S. Forest Service ends up contracting out a lot of the trail surveying to third parties because a lot of their budget is devoted to fighting forest fires. So they rely on volunteer organizations and other people to help them maintain trails and really survey them to make sure they get enough funding to keep them updated. So hopefully in the future we're going to be able to, one, you know, get veterans out with veterans in nature through our national park system, and two, give them real, actually tangible skills that they could potentially get a job with Forest Service in the future.
At this point, when you think of the good space that you've entered, is that something you work on daily at this point, or is it becoming part of your core being and much of the pain has fallen away?
I mean, it's something that I work on every day still. And I always say that, you know, a lot of the things that happened while I was deployed, you know, I'll probably never forget. But the relationship to the emotions linked to them have changed. And I really credit that to the meditation and the breathing. And that's something that I continuously do every day. So it's a maintenance process. You know, it takes work. And to maintain, you know, a level of happiness, there are certain things that you need to do, and there are certain things you need to not do, you know, in your life. And I think that when you add meditation and breathing and yoga to these, it just gives you a clearer picture of what those things are. So, it's a daily process. I mean, I still have bad days, but they don't affect me as much as they used to do. I mean, if I had a bad day, you know, before I started doing meditation and breathing, it could take me out of commission for a week, and then, you know, it would take me a week to get back on, you know, back in it, back into life, I guess you could say. So it's a process, and you know, who knows, you know, where I'll be 5 years from now, or what that will look like. But you know, it's definitely been going uphill, so getting better, I should say.
And your spirit of service runs deep.
yeah, definitely. It's the only thing I think that really, I mean, it adds such an amazing layer to life when you can be of service to other people.
The experience of veteran Tom Voss and his friend Anthony Anderson is chronicled in a documentary called Almost Sunrise. You'll find more information about the film and a link to Susan Bentz's interview with the other veteran, Anthony Anderson, at WUWM.com.
Voss now lives in Washington, D.C., where he serves as veteran liaison for Project Welcome Home Troops.
After a short break, we'll look back on the idea that started contributor Lauren Groh's current journey on the Appalachian Trail. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Appalachian Trail runs 2,190 miles from Georgia all the way to the summit of Mount Katahdin in Maine. It takes months to complete and a good amount of preparation for novice and experienced hikers alike.
Milwaukee native Lauren Groh is currently on that journey, but today we revisit the idea that started it all.
We woke before dawn, rolled up our sleeping bags, took down our tent, and packed up our rental car. It was the last day of our big California trip, so we were dragging our feet over every last minute of freedom. Our campsite was at one entrance, but we took the long way out of the park so we could pass through all the beauty one more time. As the sun was coming up, we stopped to take a few final photos of Yosemite Valley. Our friends Half Dome and El Capitan tattooed in our minds. The sun rose with us as we headed south to the airport in Fresno. We stopped at a fast food joint for brunch, then at a gas station to clean and vacuum our rental car, then again in a strip mall parking lot to reorganize our packs for the flight home. With the privileges of the last few days behind us, responsibilities before us, and home life reality ahead of us, we realized that our adventure was over. We dropped off the rental car and trudged into the airport, deprived of sleep and sad to be heading home. As we stood in line, waiting to check our bags, the events of the last few days played over and over in my mind. To think, just yesterday, we had hiked the 8 miles of switchbacks from the valley floor to Glacier Point, where we were pummeled by one of the most spectacular views in the world, possibly the same view that inspired John Muir to dedicate his life to protecting the land in Yosemite National Park. And only 2 days ago, we were driving along Highway 1, the Big Sur coastline, bringing to our minds those who had cherished it enough to write poems, books, and music about it, people like Jack Kerouac and Alanis Morissette. 4 days ago, we were humbled by the Sequoia Giants, constructing a makeshift rain awning over a picnic table and shooing bears out of our campsite. In response to a loud conversation nearby, my mind zoomed back to the present. The check-in line was long, and we were at a standstill. Eventually, the woman behind us asked if we were on a backpacking trip. We told her we were camping and hiking in Sequoia and Yosemite National Parks. "Have you ever thought about hiking the Appalachian Trail?" she asked. "My son did it a few years ago. Then he went out west and hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. But he said the Appalachian Trail was a great beginner trail. Anyone can do it." If ever there was a perfect time to bring up the topic of a new adventure, it was at the end of an old one. And that's how the idea of hiking the Appalachian Trail was born. My wife and I met that woman a year and a half ago, and 6 months later, we made the decision to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. In a few weeks, we will be following in the same footsteps of her son, likely tripping over some of the same jagged tree roots in our journey from Georgia to Maine. It's funny how a one-minute conversation with a stranger can change the direction of your life if you let it. Me? I'm headed north.
Lauren Groh is a Milwaukee native and Lake Effect contributor currently thru-hiking the Appalachian Trail. You can find a series of essays and interviews from her experience at WUWM.com. And that's all for today's edition of the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Please be with us again tomorrow morning and tomorrow evening at 10 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next. West Virginia.